was... Welcome to Animal Voices. Will Tuttle, singer, songwriter, and author, wrote, "What is so simple as eating an apple? And yet, what could be more sacred or profound? Food is our most intimate and telling connection, both with the natural order and with our cultural heritage. But it is increasingly clear that the choices we make about food today are leading to environmental degradation, enormous human health problems, and unimaginable cruelty towards our fellow creatures." Tom Evans, he used to have a wonderful program on one of the radio stations. He used to say, "The primary source of the foods we eat and the air we breathe comes from plants." Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio, 102.7 FM in Vancouver, your community-sponsored and community-based radio station. This program is presented to you by volunteer members of the Vancouver Humane Society, Earth Save Canada, and the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society. Alan Jensen is our technician today. My name is Carl Loskin. And in the studio today, we have Kelly Harris.
Hello.
And Kelly, what will you be doing today?
Today, I will be talking to a woman named Michelle Benjamin. And Michelle runs she calls it a retirement sanctuary for birds. So I'm really much looking forward to talking with her. She deals with large macaws and parrots and things.
Right. Thank you for arranging that. Also in the studio today, we have Josh Brandon, who was on the board of the Co-op Radio. Is very familiar with the studio, and he was on the board for 2 years, making it a better place. And he was a programmer on a popular program called Soundscapes, which still continues today on Co-op Radio Wednesdays at 9 p.m. He is here today because he is the agricultural campaigner for Greenpeace. Welcome to Animal Voices.
Good afternoon, Carl.
Yes, great. And now maybe you can just one of the quotes from your webpage was, "We can only go on so long sucking the life out of the soil and releasing waste into the air, oceans and rivers, before we permanently degrade the capacity of these ecosystems to sustain us." Maybe you'd just like to enlarge on these profound words here.
Well, the problem with industrial agriculture, Carl, is that it does rob the soil of its essential nutrients. And by trying to grow monocrops on large areas, large tracts of land, and trying to supplant production by pouring more and more pesticides on the soil, by pouring more and more fertilizers, artificial fertilizers, you end up degrading the soil in the long run, but you also create excess waste that flows into other ecosystems. And so those two problems are going to be enormous challenges that we'll face over the next generation, especially as we see global warming become a crisis of global proportions. Because one of the major problems that we're concerned about is that all that nitrogen fertilizer that we're putting on the soil, it turns into nitrous oxide, which is one of the major contributors to greenhouse gases. And that's something we need to reduce in the short term and bring down to much more sustainable levels over the next generation. If you think about it, over the last 45 years, we've increased the amount of nitrogen we're putting on the soil globally 800%, so eight times as much nitrogen as we are putting on before. And that's not sustainable. You can't continue increasing something 8 times every couple of generations. Pretty soon, you're going to have to pull back. The reason why we're doing so much artificial nitrogen is because over the previous generations, intensive agricultural methods have robbed the soil of its fertility. Now, if you practice organic farming techniques, natural organic farming, it actually can contribute to the buildup of soil over the long term. So it doesn't have to be this way. The Food and Agriculture Organization at the United Nations has said that we could feed the world using organic agriculture, but instead we're turning to cash crops, we're turning to large-scale meat production, and we're turning to industrial monocrops, including genetically engineered crops.
So it's not the use of fertilizer, but it's the overuse of fertilizer in a very irresponsible way. And as you just described about the nitrogen, surely this is creating imbalances, this fertilizer, and the whole topsoil thing is really a problem. So maybe you mm-hmm. can just enlarge on that there.
Sure.
It takes thousands of years to build up even 6 inches of good topsoil, and it's being depleted and washed down
yep.
and mixed up with these fertilizers.
Well, one of the big concerns we've noticed is eutrophication caused by excess nitrogen and excess phosphates on the soil. And so you're starting to see habitual dead zones forming in lakes and rivers and off oceans. So it's a problem on every continent, and it's a problem in every ocean. We see the Gulf of Mexico, for example. It's huge amounts of land where, because you're putting so much nutrients, it's coming down through the industrial agricultural heartland of the U.S., through the Mississippi River and into the Gulf of Mexico. You're seeing algal blooms that form there, and what happens is the excess nitrogen that goes into the river and into the ocean feeds the algae, and you see an population explosion of the algae in those areas. And as the algae grows, it sucks the oxygen out of the water and chokes the ocean of all life forms, including fish and other organisms that live there. So that's one of the big problems. You see that again, for example, across lakes in Quebec and particularly in Lake Winnipeg in Manitoba. It's a big problem, especially with all the hog farms that you have
now,
there.
Now, I hear you're living part-time in Winnipeg, so we just discussed about Lake Winnipeg. I mean, and maybe also we can just say something about Georgia Strait. You said something over the phone, quite optimistic, or it wasn't as bad. We're concerned about this runoff now from from agribusiness.
Well, you know, the Lower Fraser Valley is a big industrial heartland of Western Canada, and we're seeing more and more nitrogen and more fertilizer being used on the farms, especially as the price of corn is going up in the past couple of years. I've noticed larger areas being turned to silage and corn growing in the Fraser Valley. And that does tend to use a lot more fertilizer than some of the other crops that we've seen. So there's a danger that we could see the area around the Fraser Delta become a nitrogen problem there. At present, we're blessed with a lot of rainfall here that does tend to wash it away. But we can't expect nature to protect us forever. We do have to start reducing things ourselves.
So the Georgia Strait gets a good dose of water dilution here, and maybe it's not quite the same in Lake Winnipeg?
Well, Lake Winnipeg's a bit, Manitoba's a bit drier than Western BC, but we also don't have as many hog farms here.
Josh, Kelly has a question for you.
I just have a question. Is it possible to fertilize in a way that doesn't have this nitrogen runoff? Is it just that the farmers are overestimating the amount of fertilizer they need, or are we getting greedy with our corn crops? Does corn respond particularly well to fertilizers? That way we dump it onto the corn crops. Like, is there a way to just cut back the fertilizer or monitor it so that we don't have these algal blooms and this kind of runoff?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things. I mean, one is that farmers don't have any disincentive to over-fertilize at present, so you need to have some regulations to ensure that they're not using too much fertilizer. You need to have programs to help farmers use fertilizer in a smarter way. There's technologies now that can target fertilizer to particular areas and particular times where you're using GPS technology, for example, and that can help reduce fertilizer by making applications smarter. The other thing is with the corn in particular, we're finding that genetically engineered corn production across Canada is leading to an increase in fertilizer usage. So in Ontario, for example, for a few years, we actually were seeing a decrease in the amount of fertilizer used in Ontario, but then the last 2 years, we've started to see that tick up again with the increase of genetically engineered corn.
Now, Monsanto, in their approval application for genetically engineered products, said that it would reduce the amount of pesticides. And now you're saying that's exactly the opposite, that it's increasing the use of pesticides.
Well, the interesting thing about genetically engineered corn is that a lot of it is either grown either to produce its own pesticide. So Monsanto can say, well, we're not applying artificial pesticides because the corn plant itself is producing its own artificial pesticides. So it's a bit of a semantic, technical difference that they're trying to make gains from. But the problem with that is that we don't know the safety of those pesticides that the genetically engineered corn plant's producing. The other type of genetically engineered corn that we see grown here in Canada actually is designed to be used with Monsanto's own brand name herbicide, Roundup. So, I mean, there you're almost guaranteed to have an increased amount of herbicide used because that's what the corn is designed to do.
Now, we're really concerned about that so much of this product, the grains that are being produced right now, are fed to animals. Mm-hmm. And so much of the grains that are being produced, that legislation has been put through to increase the amount of ethanol. Mm-hmm. So maybe our agricultural campaigner can tell us about that.
Well, just in regard to animal production in particular, animal production is one of the worst problems for greenhouse gas emissions globally. I mean, if every time you eat a quarter pounder at your local burger store, you know, you're emitting 3 or 4 pounds of greenhouse gases into the air. So it's that kind of 13-12-1 ratio of amount of beef you're eating to greenhouse gas emissions. And globally, actually, we're seeing that agriculture is becoming one of the major contributors to greenhouse gases around the world. 6 billion tons of greenhouse gases are emitted into the air every year because of agriculture and largely because of meat production. Meat production being the biggest component of that. And you think about 6 billion tons, it's probably hard for the average listener to imagine what that's like, but I like to think of it as every second and a half every day throughout the year, it's like filling up a Zeppelin airship with greenhouse gases and sending it off into the atmosphere. It's a Hindenburg disaster every second and a half.
Wow, every second.
Now, on your webpage, I'd like to ask you about this, to enlarge on the sources of greenhouse gases, because there was a wonderful description there of where it's all coming from. Like people say, well, I mean, we're growing vegetables here, that's pretty clean, but that is in fact not so.
Well, I mean, the agriculture is actually responsible for between 17% and 32% of greenhouse gas emissions globally, especially if you take into account land clearing. And that's a big problem, especially in the global south, areas like the Amazon, where an area over the past 45 years or so, basically the size of Newfoundland and Labrador, has been clear-cut for crops, and in particular for pasture land. And if you think about it, a forest with all the trees and all the soil contains so much carbon. It's a big storehouse of carbon. And when you chop that all down and turn it into grasslands on which your cows or sheep can graze on, it contains much less carbon. So that's one of the biggest contributors. As well, you see, for example, methane from the cows and other cattle that we produce is a big contributor, because they have those digestive systems that break down the cellulose of plants, and that all goes into the atmosphere as well. And methane is a much more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide even. So those are big concerns for us.
Now, they produce lots of gas, but it's also fertilized soils that produce greenhouse gases.
Right.
Fertilized soils.
Yeah.
Well, how's that?
Well, the fertilizers that we use, nitrogen is one of the major constituents of fertilizer that we put on crops here in Canada and around the world. And so what happens is that fertilizer, that nitrogen, combines with oxygen and forms nitrous oxide, which is one of the three major gases that contribute to global warming, nitrous oxide, methane, and carbon dioxide. So every time we pour on artificial fertilizers onto our crops, then that not only robs the soil of its long-term longevity, but it also destroys the atmosphere.
Now, maybe the big ethanol question, maybe you can just enlarge on that as well, and what's happening there. Is this a wise way to go? Are we really burning clean gasoline here when our gas is has the added ethanol in it?
Well, burning food is not a solution to our energy problems. It's not a long-term solution at all. It's not even a short-term solution, because, like we were talking about, actually growing the corn produces a lot of greenhouse gases. What it does do is it causes the price of food to go up around the world. People in Mexico are finding that the price of tortillas have increased fourfold over the last year or so because of the ethanol boom in the United States and in North America. So it's a huge social justice concern. It's not a solution to the environment, and it's a subsidy to industrial agriculture that's been a big part of the problem. It's not a solution at all.
Now, earlier in this discussion, you talked about 45 years ago, and we saw this change over in agriculture, where our food was produced from family farms, and we now have factory farms and ethanol, and this is just a dramatic change. And one can feel somewhat pessimistic when one looks forward and sees that the population of the planet is going to be adding a few more billions, but there must be some kind of solution here, some ray of optimism here, Josh Brandon.
Well, I'm actually very optimistic, especially here in British Columbia, where the local food movement is so strong. You know, you see hundreds of farmers' markets sprouting up in every community across the province. The 100-mile diet has just become really taking off, the slow food movement. People are really starting to think about what they're putting in their body, thinking about genetically engineered food in particular. We're seeing, we have a petition right now asking the BC government to put labels on genetically engineered food, and we've had tens of thousands of people sign our petition already. So people are definitely starting to think about what they're eating. And the good news is, actually, if we can change our agricultural practices towards more sustainable methods, we could actually see agriculture shift from being one of the worst contributors to greenhouse gases to actually being a net carbon sink and actually contributing to solving the problem. And so that's what we really encourage people to do, to start consuming less meat, to encourage their governments to put legislation forward to help farmers shift towards more sustainable production methods, and to shop locally and support your local farmers.
Now, the David Suzuki Foundation is saying that people should eat a vegetarian meal at least once a week. What is the Greenpeace saying?
Well, you know, any amount more that that you can do is beneficial. We mostly focus actually on policy solutions as an organization, and but you know, eating meat is a great personal solution that you can do to help contribute to the solution as well.
Alan?
Oh, I just, getting back to ethanol and the problem with using corn to make the ethanol, which is just, you know, you don't have to look very far to see how much of a disaster that is on so many levels. But are there alternative types of crops that can be used to make petroleum substitutes?
Sugar.
Well, there's some research that's being done on using some waste agricultural products or waste cellulose from wood fiber that may contribute as well. We're seeing some pretty good solutions that are being put forward locally towards using gas from landfills and turning that gas into fuel. I think that any amount of these solutions, though, is going to only be a very small part of the problem. These are solutions that can help us produce a little bit of fuel, but in the long term, any solution towards climate change is going to have to see vast reductions in the amount of fuel that we're consuming. We can't go on building new highways and new Walmarts and new shopping centers out in the suburbs and destroying agricultural land.
Yeah, predictions are that the price of oil is really going to skyrocket in the next few months, and that is going to force a lot of people to drive less and buy smaller vehicles. And so that's sort of a light at the end of the tunnel as far as that goes. But still, people have to. It's going to take more than that to make a significant difference.
Yeah, and the problem with allowing the market to determine what how much people drive is that it's going to be poorer people that suffer from that. And we want to see the costs of climate change be shared equally among our population.
You mentioned earlier in the interview about the hog farms in Manitoba. Can you just talk a little bit about that? Is most of the hog production in Canada concentrated in Manitoba, and what kind of environmental disasters are happening there?
Well, Manitoba is a big center for hog production in Canada, and what happens is you have, I think, a couple of million pigs living there, and you know, it's not sustainable to have that many animals in a prairie ecosystem with you know, only a couple of drainage points. It goes into Lake Winnipeg and there north to Hudson's Bay, and so the amount of waste products that are getting into the waterways there really does cause an excess amount of nitrogen within the lake that leads to some of the algal bloom problems we were talking about before. And so that's something that really needs to be pulled to a stop.
Now, this morning I was listening to a TV station from the United States, CNBC, I believe it was, and the question was said that will technology save us? This person was saying, give Exxon a hug.
Well, I don't think Exxon's technology will save us. I think that there are creative technologies out there. A lot of them are based on local practical solutions that farmers are developing in new organic crops, for example. There's new technologies that are being developed to produce traditional crops even better than they've been grown before, without using the dangerous untested genetically engineered technologies, for example. So I think that we do need to look for new technologies, but those technologies shouldn't be concentrated into a few hands. They should be diffused throughout society so that we all have control over our future and the future of our environment.
Now, Josh, we just only have about a half a minute left here. As the the Greenpeace agricultural campaigner, maybe you can just give us in a few sentences what message you most emphatically put out.
Well, our big campaign here in British Columbia is against genetically engineered foods. We're asking for mandatory labeling of genetically engineered foods as a first step in the process of eliminating genetically engineered foods from our environment and our food system. And to help push that forward, we've actually declared March 11th, which will be this upcoming Tuesday, as GE Free Day in British Columbia. And there's going to be a number of events across the province. I encourage you to go to our website, greenpeace.ca/cropcircle. That's greenpeace.ca/cropcircle for a list of events. The morning's going to kick off actually with a protest outside Gordon Campbell's constituency office on West 4th Avenue. We're meeting West 4th and Alma at 9 a.m. on Tuesday morning. There's going to be petition signings at locations across Vancouver and across the Lower Mainland in BC. As well, we've got events at SFU, UBC, and at Capilano College during the afternoon. So please do check out our website and get involved in GE Free Day on March 11th.
Thank you, Josh Brandon. He was a host on Soundscapes here on Co-op Radio on 102.7 FM. And thank you for coming in into the studio today.
Thanks a lot.
Right. And Alan, maybe we can just have some soundscape music. Do you have some Bartok or Schoenberg?
I'm afraid not. I just have Jane Bonnet queued up. Now, Jane Bonnet is a great Canadian woodwind player, and tomorrow's International Women's Day, so I thought I should play a piece of music by a great Canadian woman performer. So we'll have a few bars of that while we get ready for the next interview.
Thank you, Alan. Yes, yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFR Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. Many of our programs are posted on our webpage, animalvoices.org, animalvoices.org. And I'd just like to repeat that if you're interested in seeing the dates of the GE activities happening here in Vancouver in this coming week, go to greenpeace.ca/cropcircle. So if crop circles is your bag, visit this webpage. And now over to Kelly Harris.
Great. We're going to proceed to our next interview subject. Michelle Benjamin is on the phone with us. Hi, Michelle. Thank you for taking the time to come into the studio with us today. How are you?
Fine. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Great. Well, I was interested. I found Michelle because I was interested in talking with somebody who is involved in bird rescue, and I found her brilliant website, itsforthebirds.net, and was reading with great interest about your work. So why don't you tell our listeners, Michelle, tell us, how did you get into bird rescue?
I really appreciate this question because it's going to give me an opportunity to go just briefly into the background a bit so that the listeners have a sense of what it is I'm experiencing here. I live mostly with large macaws. I have an African gray, but most of the birds that I'm with are large, those bright colored macaws with the enormous beaks. And I have to tell you, I've always been fascinated with birds, and I've been one of those people that has been, for the most part, afraid of everything. And as a consequence of my last 20 years of experience with the birds, I'm quite a lot better. And honestly, the birds actually chose me. But contrary to popular thought, you know, they are very intelligent creatures. That old saying, you know, so-and-so is such a bird brain is actually not very accurate. The scientists now tell us that the birds can be, individual species of birds can be as intelligent as dolphins and chimpanzees, except the birds, some of them have the vocal capacity to actually speak. So I'm in the midst of this, you know, cocoon of magic, if you like. And the intelligence that I'm in the company of is not the same kind of intelligence as people. I think one of the ways to describe the difference is that there's a nuthatch that's been studied by people who do these things. Imagine, I can't imagine how they do it. But this nuthatch, a small bird, lives in Canada, has been observed with the ability to gather seeds for the winter and store them. So they can, one bird can gather up to, listen to this. You have to let these numbers sink in. 100,000 seeds in the fall,
mm-hmm.
and then buries them within a 10-mile radius, and then can come back in the winter and from up to under 31 inches of snow, retrieve 99% of its own seed.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, I think it's definitely true that we underestimate the intelligence of birds. And with you working so closely with them, what describe your shelter? I know that you described it in your website as a rehabilitation, sort of retirement community for birds, which I thought was interesting. What is the shelter like? How many birds do you have now?
Well, this is a home-based shelter. And the birds are more like members of my family.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody lives in a cage here. They have cages to sleep in, but that's like a bed to keep them safe. But during the day, they're all in my living room. It's a playground with gyms and swings and feeding stations. And we pretty well carry on a peri party most of the day, which is basically, you know, it's based on that giggle phenomenon where if there's someone laughing in the room, even though you don't know why they're laughing, it's infectious. And so all of the birds laugh, most of them talk, and we just carry on. I have help now, thankfully, but each individual bird is met at their own level of ability, and they all have their own exercise program. They all fly. They all have their own little special routine. So I like to stimulate them enough that they experience a sense of growth, like a sense of challenge every day, because they develop, like any intelligent creature, they have a developmental need mm-hmm. that is emotional and psychological. Right. So.
Well, it sounds like parrot heaven. That's where I want to go if I was ever a parrot.
Wouldn't that? I would like to think that. Parrot heaven is probably the jungle, but...
That's true.
In a box. Parrot heaven in a box.
Now, can you tell us some stories about any... I know in animal rescue, I'm sure you're attached to every animal that you ever come in contact with, but are there any parrots in particular whose stories resonate most, whose stories resonate especially with your heart?
Well, all of the ones here do. Some of them have taken years and years to be able to get them to the level where they are now. But I'll just talk about the most recent one that's come into my house here. And this is the bird's a green-winged macaw. So that's the second largest species of macaw on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these are dark stories, and it's hard for me to speak about them. Because they're upsetting, but you know, there's some the light at the end of the tunnel. In any case, this particular bird was suffering from extreme malnutrition and neglect. It was to the point now where in my initial stages with the bird, my impression was that he was, you know, at a infant developmental stage. He was 10 when I got him, but he was still behaving psychologically and emotionally as if he was an infant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he'd been kept down away from everybody in the apartment, the dark apartment where I went to pick him up, because, of course, they're loud and hard to live with, and that's how they usually end up in someone's shed or garage or something. And he had been exposed to oven cleaner, so he had had damaged air crop and could hardly breathe. And the reason that the owner decided to find another home for him is because the other bird that was in the room died. And that's unfortunately often the case, is that people just don't know how much suffering is going on until the animal actually collapses or dies. And so when the other bird died, this motivated the fellow to find another home. And the thing that most touches me about this particular bird, it's a sweet, sweet experience, because I get to apply, of course, all my knowledge now, and I can know how to welcome them into the flock. And this one was, as an individual, was so courageous and keen to be a part of everything right away, even though he was really physically very weak. He wanted to play, and wanted to fly, and wanted to have his turn. Just like a little kid would. I've been very moved by this bird.
Yeah, that sounds. We don't think of them as, I don't know. Until you get to know an individual bird, it's hard to imagine that they have the kind of personalities that our dogs do, for example.
Well, birds are the only other animal besides mammals that like to play, mm-hmm. and I think that if to overlook that is to really rob them of something important.
Now, speaking of that, you know, the need to play, what other kinds of special needs of large birds are often overlooked by people who take them into their care?
Well, with any animal, I think it's really important to do at least a brief observation of how they are in nature, so that you can provide them with their basics. Like, they have to be able to move. Mm-hmm. You know, so birds, of course, need to fly. And I think that's one of the reasons that they go so crazy, is that they're asked to sit still in a cage for years. And one can only imagine what that must be like, especially if they're meant to be able to fly. Another one is that they're a flock animal. So they don't bear well by being isolated or left alone. So it was a large bird, because they make more mess and they are, you know, more dangerous if they should mm-hmm. decide to bite, and their screaming is very loud. It makes it that much more complicated. So to respond intelligently to their needs.
I think you're right about the mess. I grew up with a cockatiel, and let me tell you, if you let them out of their cage, they poop every, minute and a half or something, and it's messy, and it stains, and I can't imagine a parrot, which would be, 10 times the size of our little cockatiel, having its way in my house, So, they definitely have a lot of special needs.
Yeah.
And what kind of special concerns are there with living with large birds? I know you mentioned things like the noise and the mess. Are there any other things that people should know if they're considering bringing a bird into their home?
Don't do it, actually. Especially if you're talking about a large bird or a macaw, I wouldn't. The natural lifespan of a large macaw is supposed to be 150 years old, and the average lifespan in captivity now is only 15. Mm-hmm. And that says a lot. If there's a situation where you have to bring them into your home, oh my God, be careful. They can hurt you. Mm-hmm. They're 350 pounds square inch per biting power per square inch can really hurt you, and they're scared.
Yeah.
So it's not even that they're vicious. They're just trying to survive, and they're misunderstood.
And
so, I've often said to people, they come to me, okay, help me, I want to do this. I want to do what you do. And I say to them, listen, honey, unless you're willing to stay home all the time for the rest of your life, wearing clothes you don't care about, with your ears plugged to the hilt, cleaning up unending masses of poop and buckets of your own blood, don't get a macaw. Get therapy.
Get therapy.
Yeah. It's just not
going
to work.
Get a cat. Well, I think we talked about this, Michelle, on the phone, that and you pointed out that macaws and many of these large birds have very recently been wild animals, and many of the ones that we see in pet stores have actually been trapped from the wild, versus dogs and cats who have been domesticated for thousands of years. So it's worth considering that these are, like you say, maybe not meant to be pets.
Well, there's a bit of a correction there, because it's illegal now to bring in the wild macaws. The wild macaw that I have here was brought in long ago, before those laws were passed. And, they shouldn't have, if there's a wild macaw somewhere in a store, it's actually against the law. When they're bred in captivity, Kendall, I disagree with some of the tendencies that the breeders have, because they want to do the same thing that dogs and cats have done, is that they want to bond with the humans, and so they take them away from their mothers very early. And by the time I get them, one of the things that I've figured out is that they are actually suffering from almost like an identity crisis. That's the only thing I can think of to compare that a human would do. It's like they don't even know they're birds. And so, when a human being is breeding a bird in typical situation, they want to feed them every half hour, so they're tired. because that's what the mother, baby birds need to be fed every half hour for the first several months of their life. And so the human being who's doing it is often tired and overworked, and they're holding them and they're nursing them like a child. I don't know if you've ever seen a mother bird feed a baby, but there's a certain jerking motion that the mother implicates to the baby as it's regurgitating the food that's kept in the crop. And so I do that. I actually instinctively started to do that with some of these neurotic creatures, and I put my hand in their beak, and then I would imitate that motion. And you know, the relief that their whole nervous system, because the bird is sitting on my arm, I can feel their nervous system relax with that recognition, that imprint that is built, encoded into their bodies, and they didn't receive it.
Right.
And as a consequence, I think that's part of the reason why they're so crazy when I get them.
And I love that story, too, about you teaching them to fly, that you know, raising your arm up and down, forcing their wings out, because many of them have been caged for, you know, 14 to 20 years and haven't.
I can tell you, you know, that's one of the most ecstatic experiences I have ever had, is to hold, is to watch the face and feel the palpable relief that comes from a large bird who is given permission to move its body for the first time in the way it's supposed to. I cannot tell you without weeping how ecstatic that is. As sad as the whole thing is, in from a one perspective, from another perspective, the experience that I am privileged to has been powerful, profound experience for me.
Well, it sounds like these birds have had a huge impact on your life, and considering that many of them in your care right now might outlive you, what's your ideal vision of the future for your birds?
You know, if I had my way, I would have enough money and enough interest that I would build an educational center. And the focus of the center would be an aviary that's, you know, structured with intelligence around keeping the thing clean and fresh air and all of that. And then I would invite people in with varying interests to come in and learn what they need to do to get close to these birds, and then carry on this community, this flock. My worst nightmare would be if I passed away, and to think that these brave souls would all be dispersed back into the regular pet market would be, I would not rest in my grave. But the ultimate would be, and I have no idea how this is going to happen, I'm just living on a wing and a prayer here.
Literally.
But you know, I would love to be able to share what I've learned with a greater community. And if I have my way, these birds would be respected members of the community.
Yeah.
You know, that's my only hope here.
Well, you're right calling it a pet market. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
And I know we talked a little bit about exotic animals and pets, but what is your opinion about the suitability of exotic animals in general being kept as pets?
You know, let's face it, we don't know as much as we need to know. And the fact that the way people are realizing that something's wrong with the situation is that the animals are actually dying or collapsing. I mean, if we're going to be really interested in compassionate and intelligent and effective care, I mean, I think we should just put a stop to the whole exotic pet trade and you know, step back a bit and analyze it a bit more. I really would like to see, for example, that there never would be another bird left alone in a cage again, you know? It's just not good enough.
Yeah, and I think that some of them suffer extremely. And I think, too, in defense of a lot of people that have exotic animals, sometimes they just neglect the animals, not understanding their special needs, you know, and if we can just prevent that situation.
It's a question of education.
Yeah.
You know, they're good people.
Yeah, I think
for the most part, it's just they just don't have a clue what they're doing.
And now, speaking of education, I noticed on your website you have parrot parties. Can you tell me a little bit about what goes on there and if that's...
Well, that's where I took the concepts that we have developed over the years in my living room to the public a little bit. I'm writing a book right now, so I haven't been putting any of those on lately. But, you know, it would be groups of kids and their mothers, and I'd set up a situation in a space that was big enough so everyone would participate in the bit of the singing and the dancing and the listening and the watching, to try and create what I would call an atmosphere where the birds actually start to feel less shy and start to reveal the deeper qualities of their tendencies to play. And then when that happens, you know, and then to see them fly, people watch them fly, and something unbelievable comes into the room, not unlike any muse with any art. You know, there's a mystery about it. Why are why, you know, musicians understand that and writers mm-hmm. understand that. Well, this is the same other kind of thing. It's like a theater, only interactive, where I try and, you know, I invite the audience to help me create something together with the auspice, under the auspices that if anything happens, I mean, I've got to shut it all down if people don't listen to me.
Right.
It's because it is what's kind of dangerous, you know? Okay, now I'm going to put this large, violent animal on my shoulder and we're all going to sing. We're going to pray that it doesn't take my ear off.
Yeah.
You know? And it's a bit of a dangerous sport that I'm in the midst of in yeah. some ways. I have
right.
to monitor my internal temperament and
yeah.
keep it very calm.
Yeah.
Because that translates to the birds, and then I'm lucky enough not to get bit these days.
Well, I think that's always valuable. Anytime you bring people who aren't acquainted with a species of animal in contact with an animal who's expressing its personality and that kind of thing, it's, you know, people do have some pretty meaningful experiences in contact with animals, so I think it's great you're putting that out there.
It's nice to be reminded of it. I'm here socked in by myself, so thank you so much for
you're
your
welcome.
Company.
Oh, Michelle, yes, I do have one question here. That in this month's edition of National Geographic, there's a 10-page article with wonderful pictures, and it says... The caption is, it says, inside animals' minds, animals are smarter than you think. And my question relates to my pet crow. And I know you're dealing with different types of animals here, different types of birds, but I call the crow every morning. And they really like peanuts. How long will it take for this crow, do you think, to repeat my call?
It depends on how inviting you are to him.
I think Michelle Benjamin is a bird whisperer. Maybe you should have her over to meet your crow. If anyone can get the crow tamed, Michelle, it would be you.
Thank you for that compliment.
Well, I just wanted to direct our listeners to your website, which is www.itsforthebirds.net. That's itsforthebirds.net. And Michelle, are there any last words you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Don't show up at my door with your birds. I can't take any more, and I can't say no. So out of compassion, please don't show up with the birds, but you're welcome to email me. It's michelle@itsforthebirds.net if you have any questions or concerns, and I will do my utmost to give you everything I can to support your interest in the care of these exotic and magical creatures.
Well, thank you so much, Michelle, and best of luck with your wonderful work, and keep it up.
I can't thank you enough.
All right, thank you. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
That was Michelle Benjamin with It's for the Birds, and you're listening to 102.7 CFRO Radio.
And the program is Animal Voices. And yes, my pet crow lives outside in the free and wild where it should be.
Where you don't have to clean up its poo-poo.
Right.
Much better.
Right. So we certainly discourage pet stores from selling birds. These birds need to be free, and they need to there's a tremendous trade in these animals, and the tremendous prices are being paid for them. Alan, could we have a bit of music right now? And over to you. Yes, and it's Animal Voices, and we're so privileged to have John Brandon with us.
Josh Brandon.
Josh Brandon for the full hour. And over to you, Josh. You have some more news here.
Well, it seems as though pig farmers in Britain are creating a bit of a stink right now about the price of their feed, because, as you know, as we were talking about earlier, this ethanol boom that's being subsidized by governments around the world is actually creating problems for farmers in Britain and Australia and other places that are growing pigs. It's causing the price of their feed to go up. And so they had a protest singing "Stand by Your Ham." So, you know, it's interesting that that farmers really are being affected by these false solutions to climate change. And we hope that these false solutions aren't met with still more false solutions, which would be to subsidize the pig farmers. I think what we need to do is recognize that our current system of agriculture is unsustainable and move towards more of a vegetable-based agriculture system across Canada and across around the world.
Yes, and there will also be a festival happening in Tofino, Ucluelet, between the 15th and the 23rd. Quite a big festival. And they're celebrating the migration of 20,000 grey whales past the western coast of Vancouver Island. So these celebrations will be held at the Pacific Rim Whale Festival, that's what it's called, and there'll be celebrations in Tofino, Ucluelet, and at the Pacific Rim Nature Reserve. So what a wonderful, I never knew that there were quite so many whales migrating past the island, past Ucluelet, 20,000 of them.
It must be an extremely beautiful sight.
Yeah, I would think so too.
Right. So we only have a few minutes left, but I have Robert Cohen sent me a message, and he spoke about a person who went to jail a few years ago for an act that his world called a heinous crime. He let animals out of their cages and helped them find their way to nature's sanctuary, a heavily wooded area in which they would be free. Such are the heroic sagas of Disney movies told on large screens to cheering children. The reality of life results in jail for such heroes. A few years ago, after listening to his co-conspirators avoid jail by apologizing for having saved animals from becoming coats, Gary stood before a judge and said, "I stand before this court without trepidation and without timidity, because the truth cannot be suppressed today and the truth will not be compromised. One day, every enslaved animal will obtain their freedom and the animal rights movement will succeed." Gary said, "My presence in this courtroom today is paradoxical. I ask this court, if it is not a crime to torture, enslave, and murder animals, then how can it be a crime to free tortured, enslaved, and soon-to-be-murdered animals? Enslaving and killing animals for human satisfaction can never be justified. And the fur industry must understand that the millions of manual neck breakings, anal and genital electrocutions, mass gassings, drownings, and toxic chemical injections can never be justified. And the snaring of millions of free-roaming animals in steel jaw leghold traps who die slow, horrific deaths is unjustifiable as well." And he was incarcerated for all of 77 days. And he said after he was released from jail, he knew what it was like for animals to be in their cages and imprisoned in these animal factories. So, how many minutes do we have left here?
Oh, we've had at least 2 minutes.
And, well, Josh... Josh has raised his finger here.
Yeah, just one thing I wanted to let listeners on Vancouver Island know about. I think we do spread out a little bit here, Co-op Radio's airwaves.
Yeah, for sure.
And on the internet as well. And so tomorrow I'm going to Comox Valley on Vancouver Island for a roundtable discussion about creating a genetically engineered free zone across Vancouver Island. And so it's a really interesting project, because if we can start off with creating a G-free zone on Vancouver Island, then we won't be feeding genetically engineered crops to the cows over there, and it won't be getting into our food system there. So that's a really great initiative, and if you want more information about that, you can go to our website we talked about earlier, greenpeace.ca/cropcircle.
Yes, and Tom Evans used to say, the primary source of the foods we eat and the air we breathe comes from plants. And that is particularly meaningful for me, since I am a vegan. I've been a vegetarian for more than 25 years. I am totally vegetable, and we know that the body replaces itself, including the bones, every 7 years. Thank you, Alan Jensen. Do we have another minute?
Yes.
And I'd like to conclude with wonderful Will Tuttle, who is that singer, songwriter, and author. And he said, what is so simple as eating an apple? And yet, what could be more sacred or profound? Food is our most intimate and telling connection, both with the natural order and with our cultural heritage. But it is increasingly clear that the choices we make about food today are leading to environmental degradation, enormous human health problems, and unimaginable cruelty towards our fellow creatures. Thank you for listening to Animal Voices. Thank you.